some time now before we end, if time for certainly questions about anything that's been said today, or this whole area of emptiness, or really about anything in the Dharma. Really, it's open time, or about meditation. So it's just time for open questions or something, comment or something you want to share. Time is now. Please.
When it's on about laying, you talk about inner and outer paths. Could you go over that again?
Yeah. So it's a bit. So as a principle, again, what we're doing, when there's blame, there's a kind of constriction of the view onto the self of another or this self, and blaming the self, saying that self was responsible, it's the self's fault, we blame that self, this self or that self. And so we're trying to open out the view and stretch it into corners where it wouldn't go to do that. And just as a way of helping that process, because it's not the normal way the mind works, you can be a little bit contrived and think about four kinds of conditions. So inner past, outer past, inner present, outer present. Yeah. So, but it's completely contrived. It's just, and it's not like you'll find things that's kind of thing. Do you think it belongs there or belongs there? It doesn't really matter. The idea is just to stretch it. So, what was the example we used? You're talking to your friend, and there's that not real empathy. So. Inner present might be something like just the fact that you're tired, you know, something like that. Outer present might be how she's communicating it. Inner past might be, I'm still feeling a bit resentful from something she said to me 2 weeks ago that we never really talked about yet, and it's kind of blocking what's going on, that sort of thing. Yeah? Is that enough? Okay, great. So yeah, it's artificial kind of division there, but it's really an exercise, and eventually it just becomes a way of looking that you can it feels more natural and very fluid, and the sort of normal way that the looking goes, rather than the other, the contracting way. Yes.
I was just thinking about happy emotions, because we've talked a lot about sadness and anger and this and that.
Yeah.
I mean, I imagine this. Thing to do is to not claim, but it sort of got left out, and I was wondering. It must be important to see that that happiness is just as impermanent. I mean, or is it sort of it's not a problem because it's not a problem? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I mean, it seems like it just didn't get talked about today.
Yeah, yeah.
I know when I'm happy, I want to claim for it.
Right. Thank you. it came up in the Q&A earlier, and it's really important. The situation with happiness is a little richer, because, as someone pointed out this morning, it's not obviously a problem. So again, I go back to the flexibility thing. Everything, that's the ultimately deepest level, is that there's a flexibility of way of looking. The thing about happiness is the Buddha placed a lot of emphasis on cultivating happiness and different kinds of happiness and kinds of well-being. So when you do something like the loving-kindness practice, generally speaking, it builds happiness and a sense of well-being. And so that's actually really good. When you have a lot of that, it's easier to let go of other stuff. Look, if I feel overflowing with happiness most days of my life, I'm not going to cling so much to money and needing this holiday over there and that. Why? Because I have enough. You know, so happiness is actually very important to build as something that enables us to let go of other things. Yeah, but in the whole journey, eventually we also let go of happiness too, as something to. So sometimes people say, "Oh, let go. You know, don't cling to happiness, or happiness is bad, or you'll get attached to it." I would view it more as different gears. So sometimes we're in the business of cultivating happiness. And sometimes you can shift gear and be in a mode like, let's say, the impermanence practice. You say even happiness is impermanent. So whether it's happiness that comes up, or sadness, or just a kind of middle feeling, it all gets looked at in the same way. You're in a certain mode at that time of deconstructing everything. Eventually, in terms of insight, what we want to learn is that everything is empty, everything is a construction. But that understanding frees us and brings a lot of happiness, paradoxically. And eventually, it's a curious thing. When I see, let's say, a depressed feeling, or fear, and I really see its emptiness, it dissolves. And maybe it just goes to kind of neutral, open feeling, whatever. But sometimes it dissolves and it goes to happiness, paradoxically. I look at this, I see the emptiness of it, and what takes its place, takes the place of this depression, is happiness, just through seeing the emptiness of it. When I do that with happiness, and I deconstruct it and see the emptiness of it, it might actually intensify the happiness. Usually when you look at suffering and see the emptiness of it, it doesn't intensify the suffering, it dissolves it. But when you see the emptiness of happiness, it can intensify it. But in the trajectory of things, what it does is it might intensify, and then actually the happiness gets more subtle. We could say it gets less constructed, and what gets built is a more refined happiness. So a state of peace, for example, a very alive state of peace, is actually a deeper state, a more fulfilling state, and a less constructed state than a state of happiness, if that makes sense. Yeah, but it's not, again, this goes back to what someone asked earlier. Sometimes you get the impression in some teachings or some Dharma circles that the whole, really we want to just deconstruct everything. You're like a bulldozer, sort of just trying to, you know, flatten everything. And I don't know, that makes me a little uneasy. There's some things we know it's a construction, but you want to construct it because it's a beautiful construction, it's a helpful construction. So you can deconstruct and you can construct. Ultimately, we want to know that it's all constructed, but then you can choose. Does that make sense? Yeah? So go back to this real thing about flexibility and what's helpful. And sometimes happiness is really helpful. And sometimes it's even helpful even if we're attached to it a little bit. Is that enough or...? If you cling too tightly, we'll just strangle it, basically. That's what happens if we cling too tightly to anything. But certainly if we cling too tightly to happiness. But, you know, one of my teachers used to say, the path is a bit like climbing a ladder. And to let go of this rung, to reach the next rung, you actually need to grasp this rung up here. So maybe grasping happiness lightly is actually part of what moves me up, and eventually that rung too gets let go of, yeah? But if you want to, now you're aware of this because you're asking the question, again, I would just, again and again, so often with all this stuff, the answer is really experiment, play with it. Rather, careful when you're locked into, I just always do it this way. And so what happens if I do it this way? So for example, when there's happiness, take a little risk and view it through the goggles of impermanence, or view it through the goggles of not self, and see what happens to it, just out of curiosity, see what happens.
I was just wondering if when that's motivated to kind of work with happiness, because it's sort of, you just kind of sit back and...
Oh, definitely, yeah.
You know, you kind of let it be, whereas when you're sad, you have some motivation to kind of...
No question about it, yeah.
...engage yeah. these tools. You need them more.
Yeah, that's definitely true. Yes, absolutely. And I would also add something I said very briefly, is that as you start to go deeper with this thread, this construction friend, realizing the emptiness, you start to really taste the freedom at every stage. And it gives you confidence, basically, that every time I see the emptiness, it brings this freedom. And maybe that's even true for happiness, that there's a deeper sense of freedom and well-being than the happiness. And that starts to get you interested in that. And we start to become sensitive to more subtle levels of clinging and constriction. Mm-hmm. So even clinging to happiness, you actually feel it as a constriction.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. And clinging to a tight self view. So you're interested in kind of loosening everything. But it comes, you have to establish a certain amount of confidence. If I just sit here and say, let go of everything, it sounds good because it's so simple, but it's a little bit ridiculous as a teaching, because you're not going to be able to. If I'm so poor in terms of happiness, how can I ask someone to let go of happiness? It's too much. So it's different ways of doing things and actually building what's helpful to be able to do that. Yeah? Good. Please.
Why would the motivation if nothing real is real?
Really important question. I mean, my experience with this is, that's why I said earlier, is practice is the most important thing. So we can hear about this stuff intellectually, and that's a very common, as person next to you said, well, I feel uneasy. Another person, like you're saying, said, well, I don't know, I'm a bit worried about disconnecting and not caring, a kind of moral nihilism and all that kind of stuff. Very, very normal reaction, as much as relief was, or whoever said that. But so there's this whole range. But that's almost like before we really get into it as a practice. My experience is if you practice with emphasis, particularly in the kind of ways that we're talking about today, the sort of very kind of obvious steps where you're releasing suffering, you realize that it somehow brings more love, more connection, more care. We could explain a little bit of why that is, but the best thing is just to feel it and trust it, and trust that, oh, this much feels good, I can go the next, rather than take this really radical idea and then think, yikes, won't I, da-da-da, you know, which is normal, but not particularly helpful. My experience is that the more one practice-wise, experientially goes into the sense of emptiness and feels the freedom, the more love opens up. It's like there's less barriers and separation between things. Naturally, there's care there. The other thing, to add for an example, so, well, we can explain it a little bit, but so remember when I talked about, like, when the metta is really strong, there's one kind of sense of self and sense of the world, and when there's a sort of normal state of consciousness, and when there's papancha, and you've got this spectrum, right? You also start to see, if you practice the ways we've been talking about today, you start to see how much what appears to me depends on the qualities in my mind. And that starts me really... So when there's love, it's like a loving world appears to me. And so I start to really care about what's here and how I'm relating. It's not that it's irrelevant. So wrapped up in the whole journey of insight is this really central insight that it matters how much I care, because that's what gets reflected back to me. That's what, do you understand? I didn't say that very well, but does it make sense? So that's also integral to the whole evolution of the insight, is that it's we can't not care about the state of the mind and the state of the heart. The more we care, the more it opens up beauty and connection. So we start to say, oh, this matters. Yeah.
You're talking about constructions at various points of reality, and I'm just a little bit wary of the view, and I'm not sure that this really was what you were saying exactly, but I'm a bit wary of any sort of suggestion that any construction or way of looking at things is as valid as any other, and I wasn't quite sure that...
Is it really a danger for you?
No, but I mean, you do. Well, no, it's not, and it probably isn't for most people, but that's because most of us in our everyday lives treat some constructions as, in a meaningful sense true, or they're good enough generalizations, like certain generalizations about today's weather we would treat as valid, and some we would dismiss as clearly false. That is the kind of yardstick, and we test things against the evidence a lot of the time, it seems to me, and I don't know whether enough quite was said about that.
Whether what? Yeah, sure. So in the tradition, there's been a big argument about this, and just to use some technical language, there's the sort of stream of the tradition that talks about, in technical language, valid cognition of conventional phenomena. In other words, it is this and not an elephant or whatever. You know, so that's the conventional, is that it's a bouquet of flowers. You know, it's not an elephant charging at me. Okay, so that's valid cognition. And so there's a stream of the tradition that really emphasizes that's really important. And there's another stream of the tradition that says, actually, there's no valid cognition in the end. You know, I mean, we could talk about this really quite a lot. That's why I reflect it back to you. So is it really a problem? You're quite right. Generally, we take a certain amount for granted. It's not a problem. What we actually need to do is see the emptiness of things. So again, like with what's your name? Rachel. Like Rachel's question, it's more, this is all very pragmatic. Rather than trying to fix some philosophical answer and have it all wrapped up before the practice, I would say have a general understanding of where we're pointing. Start practicing with simple things. It gets deeper and deeper and deeper, and eventually that will answer all the questions that need answering without any danger there. Do you see what I mean?
I think so, yeah. And just a little bit wary that on the one hand you're implying a certain philosophy, and yet on the other hand you're saying
I am necessarily believe this. I am implying a certain philosophy. I'm also implying a way of going about
right.
it. Yeah. So, I mean, do you know much about, let's say, quantum physics or something like that?
A little sketchy.
Okay. Well, it would be a similar. I don't know how much you know, but it would be a similar thing where they say you can't. When you get down to that level, so we tend to assume, well, this is all. Okay, it's a flower, but then you get down to atoms, and then you get down to protons and electrons, and you think, oh, that's what's real, the little billiard balls. When you actually get down to that level, that's not what's there at all. It's not billiard balls. It's actually areas of probability where a thing might manifest as this, or it might manifest at that. It might be over here, but it might be over here. There's not the sense of independent reality, independent of the looking in the same. And it's not saying this atom might suddenly appear as an elephant or something. So there's a range of things that are likely in terms of positions and how it shows up as a particle or a wave. It's a similar like that. It's there's still a sort of range of how much can be perceived. But in terms of your question about philosophy, it's like, you know, I think what I was really trying to do was not so much set up a philosophy and say it's rather invite something. And then set up a way of practicing where one can follow and find out for oneself. And in that, I would say that I've never encountered for someone who's practicing a problem with the kind of thing that you're talking about.
Inviting an openness to experience. So rather than going around classifying everything immediately and saying this is how reality is, we sort of just say, well, let's wait and see what we find out.
Yeah, so like I said this morning, it's like, so when I talk about things like getting in that state of papancha, and I'm such a vortex, and this person's really like that, and I'm like this, and we feel this is so real, and this issue is like this, and after a little while we realize, oh, that was a fabrication. So the invitation that I'm trying to put out is, what if we just kept open the question of what is fabricated? That's right, and see that though there's a thread here we can follow without deciding in advance what is and what isn't fabricated. Now, in the middle of that was also throwing out like a little temptation thing, because some people it just kind of saying this is going much deeper than we think. If you keep open that question, what is fabricated, and don't limit it, and just keep exploring, the answers will be quite revolutionary, but without imposing that as an idea first. So it's really practice again. Yeah? And my sense, again, with people who have ideas without practicing and maybe have certain imbalances psychologically, etc., yeah, all kinds of is possible. But generally, for most people, the tendency is to solidify in this sort of common sense way. And what needs to happen is practice, you know, goes deeper and deeper, starts unsolidifying. There's never any danger of craziness or inappropriate or selfishness or, you know, lack of morals. It tends to take care of itself through the practice. That's my experience. So, yeah? Okay, good. Yes?
But going back to blame and responsibility, because I think that was very damaging. When I did the blame practice, I became aware that what got me, a small child curiously blaming, was when I felt that someone had not done what they were responsible for.
Yeah.
That was part of that. And then it put me back to, moving on from that, that one still has responsibility to the world.
Yeah.
Whatever emptiness or. But it's perhaps how you approach or how you load or how that responsibility is charged towards you. Because if someone is blaming you furiously, you really don't want to all, and it puts you completely off, doesn't it? So, I don't know, I just felt, well, actually, maybe the answer's somewhere around responsibility, but taken a little bit lightly.
That's one answer, yeah. So it's like, you know, we can talk about responsibility and entertain that notion, and similarly entertain the notion of self that that involves, and but we can hold it lightly, you know, and that the emptiness is part, seeing emptiness is part of what allows you to hold different perceptions and conceptions lightly, like responsibility of self or whatever. Story, it's another thing, story, my personal story. I can concretize it and constrict around it, and or I can hold it very, very lightly and actually see, well, there's more room in there than I thought, for instance, not quite as real as I thought, but I'm still holding it. You know, that's one answer. And the other answer is what we said before, is about flexibility. So some situations, some times in life or whatever, require entering into this view of responsibility. My moral choice now, the buck stops here, whatever it is, whatever way of, you know. And other times it's much better to just not see in terms of responsibility. Yeah, so there's a flexibility there.
How would you not see it? How would you get out of seeing it as responsibility?
It depends what we're talking about, but something like the blame practice we did is opening up the view beyond the notion of that person or me was responsible for that. So it's seeing it in terms of conditions, for example, that would be one way.
A condition?
Like were you here for that this morning? I can't remember.
I think I missed it.
Oh, you missed it. Okay, we did a whole thing about seeing in terms of wider conditions instead of seeing in terms of the self.
Oh, yeah, of course.
And that would be one way of doing it. But am I answering your question?
Well, you're helping.
Okay.
I don't think it's got a total answer, but yes, it's sort of yes.
Okay. Do you need anything more right now? Or
no, that's fine.
Sure? Mm-hmm. Okay.
Not really a question at all, but I was just thinking about that sort of process of the falling away of self or whatever, when you realise the inevitability to reactions with people, and it opens up all this possibility and this freedom you're talking about. It's also kind of sad about lost time or something, or the times that you kind of maybe got something wrong, but you know, it's just a goes alongside that somehow, doesn't it? We can be the joy and the potential to be
open. Yeah.
And also these kind of things that are gone.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, do you need an answer for a response? No. okay. but yeah, it can happen. Yeah, definitely. And I disagree with this, but that same teacher who said the thing about the ladders also said that basically, in insight, I don't agree with this, but insight is basically seeing how stupid you've been. and it's hard. It's hard for that reason. I'm not sure I agree with that, but there's sometimes something of that, and there can be the sense of, oh, what a waste. I was caught in that for, you know, not just a few minutes or hours, but sometimes years and years or decades in a certain way of solidifying something about me, and yeah, it's like, ouch. Going back to that therapist story I told you about, that was so intense for me, and so painful, and so stark, that it was almost like the very extremity of it made that so clear. Yeah. That it was so obviously, at some point, it's like the coin just dropped, and had it not been so strong, and so kind of, blatant like that, it maybe would have taken me longer to learn that, but it was so clear that once that coin dropped, it was that's it, and I can no longer even think about in those other terms anymore. It was like, so sometimes the things that are most painful and most stuck, it's like the very black and whiteness of them is actually a gift, painful as it is, because it's like you really learn something. So it's kind of swings and roundabouts. Yeah. What do you think?
I think so.
Yeah. Yes, please.
Just have a
a beginner's question.
Sure, please. That's good.
Just starting practicing meditation, but just this is just what I've been thinking a little bit about the exercise you did with the point this morning.
Mm.
So an idea that I'd sort of taken from some introduction that I've had is not to be too analytic or try to do much in the way of problem solving in the course of meditation.
Mm.
So I don't necessarily know if it's the right way to think about what the exercise was.
Mm.
It was that a kind of problem solving or taking an issue
mm-hmm.
into meditation.
Yeah.
In your case, you know, the example of a blame situation where, and you take that in and you kind of make that a focus of your meditation.
Yeah.
Is that something, is that a kind of problem solving, or that's one question. The other is that something that is better left for, you know, a more experienced person? Is that something that...
I think it varies, to be honest. For myself, I mean, sometimes when you hear about insight meditation or mindfulness practice, you get a very idea, oh, this is how you do it, and you don't do that kind of thing. You don't deliberately bring something, and you certainly don't bring something that involves thought. You're trying to kind of put thought aside and relate to things and see things in a much simpler way, trying as much to leave the verbal out of it and the sort of machinations of mind. But to me... it's still open as a possibility, and it's valid, both, you know. So again, you're back to this different gears at different times. You understand? Yeah. Whether it takes more experience to do that, I'm not sure. I mean, sometimes it will, because sometimes this thing, a person can't even keep the mind focused on an issue, so forget about it, you know. And or something comes up emotionally, and they have no way of dealing with that emotionally because they don't know how to work with their emotions mindfully. So sometimes it does take a bit of skill, but it's also the kind of thing that you could do in an armchair, just with a piece of paper, thinking through it, writing it. It's still valid as something that's opening up the view. So it might be meditative, it might be reflective in the armchair with the paper. But it's all good as ways of freeing. What I would say, it's all practice. So you, in this other gear where you're not so much engaging the verbal and the mental that way, you're practicing a certain way of relating to things, which is actually really helpful, but it's not the totality of what practice is about, certainly not. It's good to develop that, but not only that. Make sense? Yeah. Does any more with that, or that's okay?
No.
Yeah. Okay.
Yes, can I add something to that? You gave the instruction about this cognitive engagement with I really appreciated the invitation to say things through body information.
Yeah.
So it was the thinking process of the brain and the situation.
Yes.
It was being supported by a wider.
Yeah.
Like, oh, look, and here it is in the body.
Exactly.
And what's happening to the breath.
Yeah.
So it kind of helped me not to just think about.
Yeah. To me, that's very important. But again, going back, what's your name?
Steve.
Going back to Steve. You know, your ability to do that. So I was aware of throwing that out, but your ability to just say, "Oh yeah, good idea," and "Oh, I can feel that here." Someone, not everyone has that ability yet because they haven't developed it. And so, for some people, they just don't know how to be aware of the emotions and how they reflect in the body. They just don't have that capacity. They haven't developed that sensitivity, they haven't developed the ability to hold it. So if you can, yeah, great, then you can bring the two together, and it's not just this kind of abstract, disconnected thinking, you know, which tends to be the case, we're sort of alive from here up and the rest is off somewhere. Then you can really integrate, it becomes very powerful. But for a lot of people, that needs developing through meditation. So, yeah, great, but...